It's the time of year when many high school students are working on their college applications, but for those who aren't here legally, we find out how much harder the process is. Also, for years, the Lincoln Museum's crown jewel was a fur hat said to belong to the former president. But it turns out there might not be enough proof that the hat is the real thing. And the museum and lawmakers are angry at the foundation that bought it for millions of dollars. Here's State Representative Tim Butler on WBEZ.
I think it's unconscionable that the foundation would hide this from folks when they're out there pitching members of the General Assembly, when they're out there pitching members of the public.
But first, the CDC says the flu killed about 80,000 Americans last year. That's more than any flu season in the past three decades. What do you need to know? Have you gotten your flu shot yet? That's all coming up next on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've got a fall-themed hour for you today. It's the time of year when high school students are applying for college. But what about for students whose immigration status is in limbo, whether you don't have papers or you have a work permit like DACA? We'll find out more about that. But first, as the weather changes, it might seem like more and more people around you are sniffing, coughing, and sneezing. That has been the case throughout the WILL newsroom for the past week. But when does a tickle in your throat become something more serious like the flu? Last year, it was very serious. The influenza virus was responsible for the deaths of about 80,000 people in this country. That's according to the CDC. That makes it the deadliest flu season in three decades, and almost 1 million people, 1 million, were hospitalized in connection with the flu. Those numbers are a sobering reminder that flu season is once again almost upon us. So we've assembled some experts to answer your questions about staying healthy these next few months. As always, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21STShow. Joining me on the line now is Todd Kistner. Todd's the director of the Center for Health Protection for the Winnebago County Health Department, on the line from Rockford. Dr. John Kreckman is also with us in Urbana. He's the vice president, chief medical officer for OSF Healthcare Heart of Mary Medical Center. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Todd, if I could start with you, I wonder from a public health perspective, how concerning is it to you, those CDC numbers that came out, those numbers about fatalities that were released last week?
Yes, from looking from a public health perspective, we look at it as flu is something that is can be prevented with a flu shot, as those numbers are quite startling, the number of deaths. As we look at it as we can move forward with our community in the role of public health and really promote and recommend the influenza vaccination for everybody in the community, not just for yourself, but for your family. And looking at those numbers, I'd just kind of be able to reemphasize the importance of the flu vaccine for everyone in the community, ages 6 months and older.
Dr. Kreckman, what was your thought when you heard those fatality numbers?
The 80,000 patients mm-hmm. that estimated have died. Yeah, and it was, I believe it was 10 times that number, right, that were at least hospitalized. It really knocked my socks off. I was on hospital service for many of those weeks last year. I think it lasted 19 weeks, the whole flu epidemic, and I know that being on that side of the impact was pretty dramatic. Being a father of four and, you know, seeing what my wife went through keeping the kids healthy during those time periods was also pretty impactful. In preparation for today, I went back just to look that, you know, this year marks the 100th anniversary for the Spanish flu, I think, 1819. So coming up this upcoming year. Now, that was 50 to 100 million people, but so not quite to that level, but still quite dramatic. When usually, I think in the previous records, the highest numbers of death was 56,000, so over 1.5 times as many as that.
And Dr. Kreckman, to Todd's point, there is a vaccine, there's a flu shot, there's always a lot of conversation about how effective it is. How effective was the formulation last year?
Yeah, you know, and it's really however you want to frame the response there. You could say, well, it's just 40 to 60% effective, so you might as well flip a coin, right? But you know that the numbers that are given are 40 to 60% effective. But really, what that is, it's the risk of becoming sick enough to see a doctor. So it cuts your risk of having to go into a doctor's office, which nobody likes to see a doctor. And I'm a doctor, and I still say that. But you know, it cuts the risk by half. Okay, but what it doesn't really give you the flavor of is what is the effect on the sickest amount of people. They showed for pediatric patients, much more vulnerable population, that the risk is decreased by at least 70%. And once again, I still haven't gotten a good number on the number. What is the reduction in hospitalizations? And then you take those other high risk populations, such as pregnant women. And children and adults over the age of 65. So, yes, it's 40 to 60%. That number in alone is a good number. By reducing it by at least 50%, your risk of just going to a doctor. But for the highest risk population, it is much more efficacious.
We're speaking with Dr. John Kreckman from OSF Healthcare and Todd Kistner, who's on the line from Winnebago County's Health Department. As we're talking about the flu, if you have questions, you can always call us at 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Todd, to Dr. Kreckman's point about vulnerable populations, what, from a public health perspective, what populations would you like to see particularly getting a flu shot?
Alrighty. Going from what we saw last year here in our community, typically small children, usually 6 months to 4 years old, and then our senior population, 65 and above, are usually populations that are very good at getting influenza vaccinations. The population that always between 5 and 17 and 18 to 64, the population that feels healthy or healthy and stuff like that, that's the typical group that we don't see a lot of immunization in. And so that is really the group that we're really trying to focus with in getting them to get their influenza vaccination this season, because we have our two of our most vulnerable populations, the very small children and our seniors, are very good at getting immunization. And speaking from our community, they were last year less impacted with flu compared to the age group of 5 to 17 and then 18 to 64. So it's the group that thinks, you know, we're healthy, we're working, we're going to school, we don't need a flu shot. Those are the folks that we're really trying to get the message to, that the flu shot is just not for yourself, but also for your family. So for us, the target population is the in-between age group, and working with them to ensure that they get a flu shot this season.
Dr. Kreckman, to Todd's point, I wonder what your response would be to healthy adults. We posted on Facebook that we were having this conversation this morning on our Facebook page and already got comments from people saying that they would not get a flu shot. And I wonder what your response would be to healthy adults who say they don't want to get a flu shot.
Well, I agree entirely with Todd there that there's the issue of what they call herd immunity. And, you know, I think that's a line out of a book that I read not too long ago, that it's not about you, that, you know, it certainly could be about you. And certainly the CDC ever since 2010 has recommended universal vaccination for everybody over the age of 6 months old. But, you know, it really is almost a civic duty. And it's, you know, we talk about the high risk populations, the children, you know, people over the age of 65, anybody with any other, you know, any other significant medical problem, whether it be diabetes. I mean, we all know those people. And nobody just gets the flu. People get the flu from somebody else. And so you have to not, I mean, yes, it is important to protect yourself. Some people, that's not, maybe isn't it enough to motivate them. But really the issue is what about the people around you? What about your loved ones? What about the people you know, you go to work with? You know, really, by you're protecting them simply by taking yourself out of the influenza equation through what they call the herd immunity. So, absolutely, everyone should be vaccinated. And also with Todd, there, it is the in-betweeners, the people who don't feel the need, you know, aren't worried about themselves and their own medical problems. They need to just stay focused on those around them.
Right. So you're saying if a healthy adult gets sick, they're probably okay. They will, that's not something, that's something they could recover from very quickly, but that could be passed on to someone who's more vulnerable. Is that the point?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, just to take that one point further, the vaccination rates in the United States have been pretty flat. They're targeting around 70. They're targeting universal, but I think that their first goal is 70-75%. U.S. vaccination rates have been around 47%. And in college students down here in Urbana, that's a big deal. It's much less than 40%. Once again, to Todd's point, they're just too healthy. They're afraid of needles. They're willing to convince themselves that the vaccination is not effective. But even in children last year, when we had such a vigorous, and headline-making influenza season, the vaccination rate in children actually dropped off. I thought that was pretty remarkable.
Right. So it's just about more than 40% of children did not get a flu vaccine last year. Dr. Kreckman, you mentioned a shot. I understand there's also a flu spray that's available this year. Can you tell us about that and how effective that is? Is it as effective as the vaccine shot?
So, yes, I can. There's the shots, the standard shots, right? There's the trivalent shots, which cover two types of influenza A, and then one strain of influenza B, and then there's the quadrivalent, which I believe that was last year, was the first year, but the quadrivalent, which covers two influenza and two influenza B strains, so A and B. So it actually provides broader spectrum. Several years ago, and I'm shooting from the hip a little bit here, but I think it was 4 or 5 years ago, they came out with the intranasal spray. The CDC says all of these are, recommended. They don't give a specific preference, so any of those options are good. A previous concern, although I may be getting a little bit off of your question here, was egg allergies. They now have several types of influenza vaccination that people with egg allergies, no matter how severe the allergy, can get. So that would be one other important part to bring up here.
Todd, before we get to other ways that people can, just a lot more common sense in terms of just preventing the flu, I do want to just go over that. It's always just a good kind of common sense conversation. But I just wanted to ask you about what the timing is of peak flu season. Sometimes it changes. What do we know so far about what we think the timing will be this year?
Okay. In the flu season peak kind of varies year to year. Speaking to what we saw last year here in our county, it was just before Christmas that we started that climb here and peaking in January. In the year previously, we started as early as around the Thanksgiving holiday. So there's a couple of things that go into that. One is the flu, when the flu arrives into a community, in the sense, if you think about that, when it arrives and how fast it can be spread person to person. So as we get into the holiday season and family gatherings.
Lots of people traveling.
Yeah, a lot of people traveling, different school activities, programs, and you think of all those things that we do around the holidays and bringing people together and all of those kind of things, kind of makes a area that flu, if there is flu, be able to pass from one person to the next fairly easy. So it just kind of... it depends on a year-to-year basis. There's some factors that we watch and monitor. We do conduct influenza surveillance here at our health department to monitor the flu in our community so that we're watching week by week. If we start to see that there is that climb, then we're able to, really get the messages out.
How do you do that, Todd? How are you monitoring?
Okay. We monitor flu with our partners here in our community, which involves the medical community, our schools, and our long-term care facility. So our medical community reports positive flu tests as they are given, whether it be inpatient or outpatient at a doctor's office. Our schools are really great in letting us know about the number of kids being out sick. Usually during flu season, we try to get them to ask questions. If the students are exhibiting influenza-like illness, and to kind of help gauge that. And then our long-term care facilities, whether it be a skilled nursing facility, any place where there's a group of people, seniors, maybe.
So it sounds like lots of different places it sounds like you guys are monitoring,
so
Todd.
It helps us gauge. It helps us to be aware of the flu activity in the community, so that if there is something going on in one facility, we're able to help them try to prevent further spread and contain what they've got. So we've got a really great community model going here in flu surveillance and trying to help predict.
In the Rockford area. Yeah, thanks for that, Todd.
Yes.
Dr. Kreckman, we're almost out of time. Just a minute left, but I just wonder very quickly if you can just remind us when it's important to go to the doctor and when people need to remember to stay home so they're not spreading germs.
Boy, that's a great question, because it's a, you know, you don't want to be the person who gives everybody else in the waiting room the flu. You know, common things being common, nothing wrong with staying at home. Chicken soup, hugs and kisses, Tylenol, ibuprofen, and just staying well hydrated. But on the other side of that coin, you don't want to, if you have any concerns, if you just don't think things are going well, you know, most places nowadays, I know in Rockford, down here in Urbana, they have a very robust phone-in nurse. So you pick up the phone and you
that's
call
a good
and
idea.
Start walking through your symptoms. And that those are available in many places 24/7. So
yeah, that's a good idea. I'm sorry to cut you off. I'm afraid we're out of time, but that's a good idea to always call in before you go to the doctor. I want to thank Dr. John Kreckman with OSF Healthcare Heart of Mary Medical Center, Todd Kistner with Winnebago County Health Department. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's college application season for many students across the country. There's no shortage of forms to fill out, scholarships to apply for. The whole process can be very daunting. There are lots of hoops to jump through, and college is expensive. And if you're not a citizen or permanent resident, the process is even harder. Whether you don't have any papers at all or have a work permit like DACA or temporary protected status, your immigration status means that lots of options are already closed off to you when it comes to college. And we're going to talk in a few minutes about what this looks like for officials in higher education. But first, we wanted to hear from someone who has firsthand experience with this issue. Elizabeth Zakis is a junior at North Park University in the Chicago area. She's a chemistry major. She's with us at our studios at Northwestern University in Evanston. Robert Emmons is also with us. He works at a college access organization called One Goal. Elizabeth, Robert, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Elizabeth, I understand that you are a DACA recipient now. That's something that you were able to get in high school. I wonder, though, when you were thinking about high school and thinking about applying for college, how did your immigration status affect all of those decisions?
Well, I didn't get my DACA status until my sophomore year of high school. So I remember, like, my freshman year of high school, everybody was getting their work permits because, like, it was just fun. Everybody was about to start working, saving up money, and I just could not do that. So it was really, like, a hard start, because I already knew, like, going into high school, I was ready to apply for college as soon as we had the ability to, but I just didn't know how I was going to do it.
And then when you thought about going about how, at what point, so when you were a sophomore and you got through the whole process of, that's when you first heard about, by the way, I should mention to our audience, you wrote a great piece about this in Teen Vogue that we will tweet out that tells more of the details of your story. Elizabeth, when you heard about the whole idea of DACA, did you think this will help me in so many ways, including college?
I was super excited to have the opportunity to work because I literally was seeing everybody working and I was not able to. So that was like awesome to me.
Mm-hmm. But then how did that work in terms of you could work? And so you were able to work and save money for college, but were you eligible for things like federal loans?
No, I wasn't. So DACA just gives you like work authorization and a social security number, but you're still not able to apply for the FAFSA, which is federal aid. So I knew the only way I was going to get like afford paying for college is through scholarships because my family only had so much they can give me. So scholarships were my number one goal because it didn't really hit me until like my junior year of high school that I was not able to afford college.
Well, I think it probably doesn't hit most people. I think it hit you earlier than most people because I think a lot of people think about that their senior year. So how did you handle that? Did you just apply for as many schools as possible and then you thought you would try to see what kind of scholarships they offered you?
Yeah. So with one goal, they actually my sophomore year of high school, it was junior year. But my junior year of high school, we actually like took different tours of schools and I just applied to so many and I did so many scholarships and I wasn't getting any of them back to back, like up all night just doing so many scholarships. And then finally like I got but they were like really little scholarships, like $1,000, but then finally I got like a full ride scholarship. But then that was a process, and then finally I got another full ride scholarship at North Park University and I got to do a video for them. So it all worked out. But it just took a lot of hard work and dedication.
Robert, as I mentioned, Robert Emmons is with us. He works at One Goal, and that's an organization that helps all kinds of high school students with college access. Robert, how did you meet Elizabeth? How did you guys link up?
Oh, really good question, actually. So now I was actually in the program in high school, One Goal graduation, and now I'm working full-time on staff as the manager of program innovations. And if Liz doesn't mind me telling this short story, a few months ago, Liz was having some trouble paying for college, and she reached out to a really powerful person that works at One Goal, and this person reached out to me and asked if I had any additional resources for Liz, and I reached out to Liz, and together we put together a plan to help fund the rest of that gap that Liz had in terms of paying for college. So that's how I met Liz, and she's an extraordinary person, and it's just a blessing just to be in her presence.
Thanks, Robert. You're so awesome.
Robert, I can see that you guys have a great relationship. What kind of work have you done to help Elizabeth get settled? It sounds like just that was what you did most recently, but what about on the front end when she was thinking about applying?
I'll let Liz talk a little bit more about like that relationship.
So, Robert actually helped me tremendously because I was having a hard time paying like my extra fees for school because my DACA money got lost in the mail. So Robert made a GoFundMe account through One Goal and we raised more than enough money that I needed. So I value Robert and One Goal so much for that.
So when you say, what happened to you, when you say your DACA money got lost in the mail, you mailed in the money for, was this for renewing your DACA registration?
Correct. You're supposed to renew it about like 4 or 5 months in advance, which I did. And I was just not getting no responses at all about what was going on with my renewal. So after like several phone calls and weeks, they finally took time to tell me like they sent it back, but I never got it back in the mail because the money was short by like $10. And it was a money order, so they sent it back, and it was just lost in the mail.
Oh, wow. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that must have been... So when that money was lost in the mail, then you lost the money?
Yeah, it was like $700, and I had the receipt, but I got it from, like, a Western Union. So it was just... I was trying to work with the Western Union. It was just... Usually the first time I did with a lawyer, but I was told, like, it's just really basic paper application. You just send it in with the money order, and you should be fine. So, yeah, I just lost $700 and then I had to redo it and pay a lawyer again with that $700 and then the lawyer fee.
And did you get your renewal?
I did. Okay. Yeah. So, but I wasn't working at that time because it took so long that my DACA actually did expire. My work authorization expired. So I was like, it was just a lot going on.
How much work have you been doing while you're in college, Elizabeth? Jobs to support yourself?
I mean, so I... currently like work at Mariano's. I'm like the shift lead and they're training me to be in the pharmacy because my goal is to go to pharmacy school. So it's just anything that helps me pay for my school fees pretty much. trying to make it work.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Yeah. Robert, when Elizabeth is sharing her story, is most of the support that when we're thinking about students who are who have a legal status that's in limbo, is most of the support they need financial?
I wouldn't go as far as saying just most of it being financial. I think there's I think it's multifaceted. I think there's a lot of systemic barriers that students face when enrolling in college. But the thing I can say about One Goal creates responsive resources for both our fellows and our teachers. So when challenges do arise, we're ready to support them in a bunch of different ways. And I think that's one thing about One Goal is we teach and we practice what it takes to be resilient and what it takes to have grit, so that no matter what's coming up against us, whether that be social belonging when you're on your first day of class not feeling like you belong, or you're not being able to pay that gap off to the financial aid office. We practice resilience and fighting through those systemic barriers to interrupt these systems.
Robert, how do students get connected to you?
It's an application process. So it's, One Goal is a 3-year model. It's beginning junior year. Junior year of high school, exactly. And students complete an application to One Goal, and then they're selected into the program. And then we help train what we call the PD, which is the teacher that actually delivers the course to the class.
Mm, okay. We've been talking with Robert Emmons, who's the manager of program innovation. He's in the Chicago office of One Goal. That's a national organization that works with students, high school students, as he's saying, to help them with college access. We've also been hearing Elizabeth Zakas' story. She's a junior now at North Park University, a chemistry major, as she's been telling us about her hopes, her goals to become a pharmacist. And I wanted to bring a couple more people into this conversation. Eric Ruiz is the director of undergraduate admissions at the University of St. Francis in Joliet. He's on the line from there. Jennifer Delaney is an associate professor of higher education at the University of Illinois. She's in studio with me here in Urbana. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Eric, as you heard Elizabeth talk about being a DACA recipient, not being eligible for federal loans, when you were thinking about the college applications process, what else is different about it if your immigration status is in limbo?
First of all, my heart breaks because I just want to be able to help out as much as I can. And Liz, if it's okay, I would love to connect with you to try to help you finish college.
Thank you so much.
Making sure you finish. But as far as the application process, we've been trying to go around to many different colleges and universities throughout the state of Illinois, a couple of us in the state, to try to talk to the admissions offices and talk about what exactly is hindering these students from applying. You know, one of them being the Social Security number and being having it be required on the application. You know, like for instance, we have a Social Security number, but we have a note there that if you don't have a Social Security number, to put zeros because we don't need it on the admission side, only on the enrollment side, really. And when it comes to us trying to figure out the college, how are they going to go to college, we try to tell people, the admissions offices throughout, that we're no longer recruiters at that point when it comes to undocumented students or DACA students. We have to be counselors at that point and have to have them have their interest in mind, as opposed to just trying to recruit them and saying, hey, this is our best college, you know, you should come here and things like that. Because as you mentioned earlier, it's not just financial, it's the mental stability, it's the, you know, what's going to happen while they're in school there. Is there other students that they can connect to? Is there other families that their family can connect to? It's a whole facet of things.
And Eric, do you think there are enough admissions counselors, people at admissions offices at universities across Illinois who are talking about this, who are thinking about this, who are working on this?
I believe so. We worked pretty hard in the state of Illinois. Maybe about 8 years ago, there wasn't a lot. But we've since then, you know, through our Illinois Association for College Admissions Counseling, ICAC, we've done a whole lot to be able to bring this information to the front. We now host the Sharing the Dream Conference for educators. We usually bring in about 300 educators throughout the state of Illinois, as well as throughout the country, to learn about how they can help and what they can do in their offices. There's lots of offices that there was a lot of offices that didn't think that they can do much, but with just a little bit of communication, there's quite a bit that any school could probably do.
Eric, do you think this is easier for smaller or for private institutions like you all, the University of St. Francis in Joliet?
I think at first the private schools were able to take that leap only because they were able to, talk to their board of trustees and do. They didn't have as many, public ties. To be able to say, hey, yeah, we accept undocumented students. I know a public school like Northeastern Illinois University is a big public university that was able to move forward before a lot of other schools. We are still working at it. We just were able to bring up our new scholarship for specifically undocumented students that gives them money every year. On top of our academic monies and things like that. Our board of trustees agreed that for any of our students that have legal fees that had to renew their DACA, we would reimburse them that money.
Wow. So that's the University of St. Francis. Jennifer Delaney's in studio with me here at the University of Illinois, where she teaches with the she's an associate professor of higher education. Jennifer, for larger state institutions, for big universities like the U of I, which is our state's largest university system, is it maybe more difficult?
Yeah, so thank you for having me, and thanks to Elizabeth for sharing her story. I think it's very brave of her, and hopefully will give hope to others in a similar situation. So I think this came up earlier, but it certainly is the case that it is more difficult for public institutions to support undocumented students. And oftentimes in those admissions processes, undocumented students count as international students, even though they graduated from a local high school.
Oh, so then do they have to pay international student tuition?
Right. So finances are where this gets to be incredibly difficult for undocumented or DACA students to attend college. We currently have 17 states that have state-based DREAM Acts that allow undocumented students in-state resident tuition. We've got 3 states in the country that do not allow undocumented students in-state resident tuition. Illinois is one of the 17 states that does allow in-state resident tuition, but those are state-level laws that then sort of govern what public institutions can do. We've seen a lot more with private institutions, and I certainly can call out Catholic institutions doing a lot, raising institutional funds, having specific scholarships for undocumented students. Although undocumented students show up at public institutions, in general, those targeted scholarship funds for them aren't able to exist within the public setting.
So the state laws in Illinois, how would you characterize those? As you mentioned, Illinois has laws that allow for in-state tuition. Are there other laws in Illinois that make it easier for students here?
So the other thing Illinois has, in 2012, we passed a DREAM Scholarship Fund. So it's a state-based fund that doesn't have state money in it. It's intended to bring in money from philanthropy, and it is open to both DACA and non-DACA undocumented students. The scholarships are worth up to $2,000 to attend a community college, up to $6,000 for 4-year institutions. So as a state, we've got the space for undocumented student aid, and then we also have that state law that allows them to get in-state tuition rates.
So would you say that Illinois is doing well compared to other states when it's trying to help, at least compared to how other states are doing?
Certainly. We're in that group of trying to promote. I think there are slightly more progressive policies in Texas and California, but Illinois is in that group of states that are trying to help undocumented students get access to college.
We have to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Jennifer Delaney and Eric Ruiz and also Elizabeth Zakis. I want to thank Robert Emmons for being with us. He's a manager of program innovation at One Goal, for sharing with us a little bit more about their organization. As we said, they're a national organization that helps all kinds of high school students with college access. Robert is in their Chicago office. If the rest of you guys can stick around, we're going to take a short break here, but we'll continue this conversation after the break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guests are Elizabeth Zakas. She's a junior at North Park University. She's a chemistry major. We've been talking to her, Jennifer Delaney at the University of Illinois, and Eric Ruiz at the University of St. Francis in Joliet, about this time of year when high school students are applying for college. But what happens if you're a high school student whose immigration status is in legal limbo? How does that affect your application process? We've been talking about how Illinois is a little more different than other states in terms of being accommodating to students who are in this situation. Jennifer, I just wanted to ask you about, just to follow up, I imagine this gets so complicated. I think just when we think about the paperwork of just applying for college, that in itself is a very daunting process. Are there other aspects to this in terms of like FAFSAs and other things like that, if you have DACA, that you, any misconceptions you want to clear up for us?
Yeah, so college is hard and complicated for everyone. For DACA and other undocumented students, it's just exponentially harder to try to navigate the system. And those are often students that don't have resources, which is why organizations like One Goal that can help students like that is so important for undocumented student access. So annually, we've got about 65,000 undocumented students that are graduating from U.S. high schools each year, but only 5 to 10% of them, according to the College Board, are actually attending college. So it's a daunting, difficult process that not a lot of them are getting through. Elizabeth, in telling your story, was absolutely right that undocumented students are not eligible for federal aid. However, they are DACA students with Social Security numbers are able to fill out the FAFSA, which is the free application for federal student aid. And that form does not ask about parental citizenship, which is a really important thing for undocumented students. The only thing, and it doesn't ask about self-citizenship either. While you wouldn't be eligible for federal aid, a lot of other programs, including private scholarships, use the FAFSA as their application form. So that can be an important pathway for students to get access to student financial aid. The other sort of new area in student aid has been the development of locally based or community based promise programs. And there is some evidence coming out of those because they're not actually student aid. What they're doing is waiving tuition. You get free tuition if you're from a community. And like the Chicago Star Scholarship that is tied to graduates of Chicago Public Schools, we've seen an uptick in undocumented students actually enrolling in the City Colleges of Chicago because of that promise program, right? It's a different sort of application
fee. So this
fee.
Is kind of similar. Is this based on the Kalamazoo promise? Is that what this is modeled after, Michigan?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very similar. So you have to be from a place, and that includes undocumented students often in those promise programs.
Eric, how hard is it to get all of this information to students, as we've been talking about, on top of all the paperwork that comes with applying for college in general?
It depends on the resources that the student has at the high schools, which is why we're trying to reach out to the high schools. It could be as easy as going through, for instance, our IACAC website, and we collect information for the undocumented students of two-year and four-year colleges. Throughout Illinois and some out of state, and we ask specific questions like, what they should do for how to apply, what should they do for their Social Security number, who is the contact person, and things like that. So we try to collectively gather all that information so they only have to look for one spot. But there's so many organizations out there. Sometimes I still meet students today. I'm meeting some families tonight. That are wanting to talk because they just don't know how to start looking, and they don't know who to ask or what to ask, even though their college counselor is just down the hall from them. Sometimes they just get nervous for asking. They've never been able to talk about this in public, some of them. Sometimes their families won't allow them to do that. So we have to work on every different avenue to bring the information to them.
Elizabeth, what do you want our listeners to know about your experience? I know you've said you, when you graduate, you would like to, I guess, go to pharmacy school to become a pharmacist?
Correct. So I just feel like I want to let the listeners know that I basically lived here my whole life. So it's kind of deteriorating. Like, it's just hard knowing that I'm like everybody else and I've spent like all my life in the United States and I'm not able to have the same support and opportunities as others who've just were born here. So, and with what he was saying before, I feel like sometimes as students, we just need support. And that's really the most important thing. We just don't know how to start start the applications process or knowing what we need to do. So I just feel like support is the number one thing we can give students who are in that situation, because applying for college by itself is really hard, but then being an immigrant at that makes it 10 times harder.
And it sounds like you've done a great job finding that support for you. I appreciate you sharing your story with us. That's Elizabeth Zakis at North Park University. I want to thank Eric Ruiz as well with the University of St. Francis and Jennifer Delaney with U of I. Thank you guys for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you've ever been to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, you may have seen one of its most precious artifacts, a stovepipe hat that was supposed to belong to our former president. It's been there for more than 10 years, thanks to the Lincoln Foundation, which bought it for millions of dollars. But it turns out that hat might not be the real thing. There are now some serious doubts about whether there's enough evidence to prove that this hat belonged to President Lincoln. And that's a big problem, not just because this is one of the museum's most prized possessions, but because the foundation still needs help paying off the money it borrowed to buy the hat in the first place. WBEZ's Dave McKinney broke the story, and he's on the line with us from WBEZ now. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, good morning, Nyla.
So before we get to some of the finances of this, I wanted to hear the story of this hat, or at least the story of the hat that we thought was true. What were people told about this hat for people? I'm sure there are lots of people listening who've been at the museum and seen it.
Well, it started out as classic Americana. This hat had belonged to a Southern Illinois farmer, and he had passed it down after his death to his son. And then when that gentleman passed away, his widow had possession of it. So this is the late 1950s. And the story then was that Abraham Lincoln was so taken by this farmer in the 1800s coming around to believe in Lincoln's politics. Lincoln was a Republican, this farmer was a Democrat, that he decided to give the farmer, as a token of gratitude, a stovepipe hat that he'd worn. And the story was that this farmer went out to Washington, D.C. during the Civil War to get the hat. And so that story had been in existence for a few decades. And then, you know, and then somebody thought to check it. Is there any way to corroborate that story? And what they found out was, well, there's no evidence that the farmer ever went to Washington, D.C. and nothing, no evidence, photographs, newspapers, nothing that would corroborate it. And so at that point, the former state historian decided, well, let's come up with a different idea here. Let's think about where Lincoln and this farmer might have come into contact. And so at that point, and this would have been in the 90s, this former state historian said this hat must have been given to the farmer by Lincoln in 1858 rather than sometime in the early 1860s. There was a Lincoln-Douglas debate in Southern Illinois. The farmer likely was at that. That had to have been where the exchange occurred.
So was that the known provenance of the hat when the foundation bought it?
Yeah. I mean, what you had, though, really were two stories that didn't square with one another. And so what they were saying as of 2012 or so, 5 years after the hat was purchased, they were saying they were believing the 1858 version of events, which is the one at the Lincoln-Douglas debate. So it's had this sort of squishy question about its authenticity now for 5 or 6 years.
And so how does the FBI get involved with this?
Well, I mean, the FBI was called in, after really kind of a series of stories that I was involved in back when I was at the Sun-Times in 2012, where I laid the competing stories out. The foundation decided that they wanted to take steps to see if they could kind of bolster the provenance of the hat. And the FBI really was sort of the second shoe to drop in this effort. The first was that they went to curators at the Smithsonian Museum and at the Chicago History Museum and said, can you guys figure this out? And what these two top museum officials came back and said was, based on the documentation that exists, you can't legitimately claim that this hat belonged to Lincoln. There's just not enough documentation. And in that report that was issued in 2013, they went so far as to say that, the foundation might want to consider, absent any more documentation, asking the collector that once owned this hat to take it back. And those were clearly disappointing results, and so they then turned to the FBI. They contacted...
And by they, you mean the foundation.
The foundation did. And so they contacted the FBI, their crime lab in Quantico, Virginia. They do sophisticated DNA testing. They asked the FBI to come out and see if they could figure out if there was any DNA contained on the hat that might have belonged to Lincoln that would match up with, items that the foundation and museum have that you know, the authenticity is really unquestioned, you know, blood-stained gloves and handkerchiefs and things like that that were with Lincoln the night of his assassination. Long and short of it is the FBI did their testing and they couldn't come up with any positive hits.
And Dave, we just have a couple minutes left here, but I just want to ask you about the money that's involved here. So the foundation borrowed money to pay for this hat, and do they still owe money on that?
Yeah, in 2007, I mean, back up just a second. I mean, this foundation exists for no other reason than to buy Lincoln stuff that then gets displayed in the museum. And in 2007, they acquired this $25 million collection of Lincoln artifacts that included the hat. They borrowed $23 million to pay for that. $2 million was donated. And so they've steadily been paying it down, but they've reached a point where fundraising has kind of dried up for them, and they have a $9.7 million tab left on that original loan. So they're turning to the state of Illinois for help in trying to pay down that debt. And they've said if we don't get the money by October of 19, then we may have to auction some of these artifacts off.
What have they said about your reporting now, the foundation?
Well, I mean, I don't think that they are happy that people have been questioning the authenticity of this prized possession. I mean, they believe that what these two steps with the museum report and with the Smithsonian and Chicago History Museum report and the FBI report, they believe that those two things don't undermine the authenticity of the hat itself. So they're still sticking with the idea that the hat is real. Now, the museum director, he just learned about this. He's been on the scene in Springfield for 2 years, and he was rather angry and stunned that all this stuff had been done, really out of the public's eye. And he's now undertaken a study that he hopes by the end of this year will shed more light on this. Until then, he's not going to display the hat at the museum.
So the hat is not on display right now?
No. Mm-mm.
And the idea is that, do you think by the end of the year there will be another twist to this years-long saga with the hat, it sounds like?
Well, I mean, you know, if he's got any, you know, I think there have been all sorts of history detectives that have been unleashed on this. And the problem is that there's just, you know, conflicting information about it. And that's just a messy situation. And you know, what a lot of people have said is, you know, this hat may be no more than a period piece, basically, you know, a hat that people in the 1850s or 60s wore. And maybe it could be displayed in the museum with the story of how, you know, they thought it was once Lincoln's hat and the sleuthing that they did to try to figure it out and ultimately what they found and how it was inconclusive. That might be, you know, that might further the museum's mission and just showing how museums work.
And the question still is, though, about that $9 million loan. That's still a big outstanding question, I imagine, Dave?
It is. I mean, they've gotten no signs of cooperation out of Governor Rauner's administration. I mean, he's not convinced that the foundation has a real way to pay back the loan or you know, he's had serious questions about the kind of the financial underpinnings of the foundation and doesn't want to commit the state to it. And it's, you know, there are legislative hearings that have been talked about to kind of explore this question about the hat and about the, you know, sort of the overall lack of transparency, I guess you could say, with the foundation and doing a lot of this stuff, you know, outside of the public eye.
We'll tweet out Dave McKinney's most recent stories about this hat in question in Springfield. That's WBEZ's Dave McKinney. Dave, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
No, thanks. Yep.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, speaking of history, we're going to turn to the city of Peoria and learn how it became a haven for Japanese Americans, many of whom had no choice but to move to the Midwest after they were put in internment camps during World War II. So join us tomorrow for that. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Kashish Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. You can always go to our website, 21stshow.org, to find past shows, give us feedback, leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us with our social media handles. All you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. See you back here tomorrow.